draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago versus North American Galvanizing and Coatings Incorporated. Mr. Jones.
May it please the court. My name is Lewis Jones for the defendant and appellant in this matter, North American Galvanizing and Coatings Incorporated. Your Honors, the district court in this case got it three quarters of the way right. It correctly held that the plaintiff cannot state a claim for contribution under Section 113 of the CERCLA statute because the contribution conditions have not been satisfied. It also correctly held that this plaintiff cannot state a claim for cost recovery under Section 107 because this plaintiff is a person with liability under that provision. The court also correctly identified the issue, which is that if this plaintiff has a CERCLA remedy, it must and can only be an implied contribution remedy under Section 107. That's the issue presented on appeal, whether such a right, an implied right of action, exists. And that's where the district court went wrong. The district court held that such a right does exist. But respectfully, I think the district court erred, and I think the order on appeal should be reversed with instructions to the district court to dismiss this plaintiff's CERCLA claims. If an implied right of contribution exists under Section 113, that right of action would necessarily conflict with the express contribution remedy, with the contribution scheme set forth in Section 113 of the statute. Congress created a contribution remedy, the means by which liability is to be apportioned among liable parties. That remedy includes conditions. Congress has specified when and how contribution claims can be brought. To recognize an implied right of contribution absent those conditions would render the conditions superfluous. It cannot be presumed that Congress intended to authorize an implied right of action that would render its express right of action and those conditions superfluous. Because the implied rights analysis is focused on congressional intent, that should be the end of this analysis. With that, the district court should have dismissed the plaintiff's CERCLA claims. Now, more broadly, the case is squarely controlled by two precedents. The first is the recent holding of the United States Supreme Court in Cooper Services versus Aviol. And that holding shuts the door to the contribution claim under 113. The second controlling precedent is the holding of this circuit in Axo Coatings Incorporated versus Egner. Axo closes the door to the Section 107 claim. Axo holds that any suit by one person with liability under CERCLA against another person with liability under that statute is inherently a claim for contribution, a quintessential claim for contribution, and as such is governed by the contribution remedy created by Section 113. Axo was reaffirmed by this circuit and followed in the Rumpke case. Rumpke reaffirmed Axo, but it also expressly anticipated the result of Cooper Services versus Aviol. It expressly anticipates that the conditions imposed on contribution claims under Section 113, combined with the limitations on the right of action under Section 107, might combine to leave some plaintiffs without a remedy. The opinion goes on to explain that this might seem to create a disincentive to voluntary cleanups in some cases, but the court correctly recognized that this is what the statute requires. Because Axo and Rumpke are squarely controlling, and because they anticipate the result of Cooper Services versus Aviol, there is no basis on which to revisit those controlling precedents. Again, that should have been the end of the analysis. The only way to open a door for this plaintiff to sue under CERCLA would be to reverse the district court and to hold that the district court got it wrong on the innocent owner issue. AXO does recognize an exception for certain persons who, although technically liable under the statute, might be deemed to be innocent in some sense of the term, transforming the case from a case to allocate liability among responsible parties into an innocent party cost recovery claim under Section 107.
There is an allegation in the complaint, is there not, of that they are innocent?
There is a conclusory allegation in the complaint that they are innocent, but the facts in the complaint show that that allegation cannot be sustained. They've pled themselves out of this exception. As the district court correctly recognized, the exception only applies in two circumstances. The first is the case of an innocent purchaser, a person who acquires property after the contamination has occurred. This is not an innocent purchaser case. The second class of cases in which the exception is applied are for landowners whose property is contaminated by third parties unrelated to the plaintiff. The key is that the person who does the contamination or is alleged to have polluted the property cannot have any contractual relationship with the plaintiff. If the contamination occurs in connection with a contractual relationship between the plaintiff and the defendant, then the plaintiff is not an innocent person within the CERCLA statutory scheme. The plaintiff is a liable party. It's one of the persons at which CERCLA is targeted, and this transforms the case into a suit to allocate responsibility between two parties whom Congress has deemed both to be liable. To apportion liability, that's the contribution claim. Now, the facts alleged in the complaint that squarely contradict the application of this exception are that the plaintiff was the owner of the property at all material times, at least since the 1940s. That's paragraph 7. The plaintiff entered into a long-term lease with the defendant in the case below, the Lake River Corporation. That's paragraph 9. Before the lease, this property was essentially undeveloped. That's paragraph 10. The leases were attached to the original complaint and therefore are part of the pleadings. The lease shows, and I quote from Article 3.05, it is understood that said premises are to be used for the storing, refining, blending, and distribution of oil, petroleum, and other chemical products, and such purposes as shall be incident thereto, including storage of such products for other persons or corporations. The lease further alleges that operations pursuant to the lease during the term of the lease are what led to the contamination of the property. Those are paragraphs 13, 14, and 15. And that hazardous substances were released into the environment as a result of these activities, paragraphs 17 through 28. Given those facts, it is clear that this plaintiff has pled itself out of the innocent owner defense. The facts here are very similar to those in the North Star Partners case cited by the district court below. In North Star Partners, the Southern District of Indiana, after undertaking a thorough review of the innocent owner jurisprudence within this circuit, concluded that a claim by a lessor against its lessee alleging contamination pursuant to the lease had to be dismissed. It was dismissed on the pleadings in a motion to dismiss, just as this one was here. I think the next thing to move on to is the competing analysis of the Second Circuit Consolidated Edison. That analysis, as you know, takes direct issue with AXO, and in order to follow that analysis, you would have to overrule the AXO Coatings case. But furthermore, I think that the Second Circuit erred. I think that the Second Circuit got it wrong. What the Second Circuit said is that the plain language of CERCLA Section 107 gives any person a right to sue under that provision. Respectfully, I just don't think the plain language of Section 107 gets you there. What the plain language does is two things. It imposes liability. It identifies a group of defendants. That's the first thing. The second is that it identifies the range of cleanup costs for which those persons are liable. What Section 107 does not do is to give any liable person a right of action of any kind. It doesn't say that they can recover cleanup costs, and it doesn't say that they can get an action for contribution to apportion liability. Now, given the common law understanding against which CERCLA was enacted, that is a major omission. The common law understanding is that there is no right of contribution among joint tortfeasors. That's the background. Congress can and has modified the common law to create a right of contribution. But as with most statutes that create contribution remedies, the right of contribution created by Congress is expressly limited and conditioned. Because Congress is the source of the right, Congress can limit the right, and that's what Congress has done. Now, I think the Second Circuit's analysis is fairly openly directed at trying to achieve a result the Second Circuit believes is consistent with good policy. I think the Second Circuit made a mistake in that regard, and I think the Second Circuit did not understand the full implications of the policy decision that it made. And I think the difference between Consolidated Edison and AXO is largely the context in which these cases were presented. In AXO, the significance of the settlement bar provisions and of the scheme that Congress created, which is really directed at forcing private parties to settle their liabilities with the government, was front and center. And I think because the Second Circuit reached this issue sua sponte in a different context, it didn't realize how its result, its holding in that case, would undermine the settlement bar provisions.
That Second Circuit didn't choose to cite Rumpke or ESCO.
It didn't cite Rumpke. It, by reference, said we do not follow some circuits, unnamed, who think that this all turns on whether you're an innocent owner. With that, I'd like to reserve
Surely.
The remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Shelton.
May it please the court, it's an honor to be here, and I hope I can do this case justice. Let me begin by emphasizing what I think is perhaps the obvious, and that is that the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District wants this court to affirm that it does have a right to sue the defendant and recover costs of its environmental response and remediation under CERCLA. Second, let me suggest that this case presents a rather unique and ideal opportunity in the wake of the United States Supreme Court's decision in Cooper Industries versus Avial Services to clarify the rights of a person such as the district to bring a CERCLA claim. We think that a right of action is created under Section 107 for a plaintiff such as the Water Reclamation District, and that it's really pretty clear, although from the briefs and argument of the defendant, obviously they seriously disagree. And in the remainder of my time, I'd like to discuss those disagreements. Let me, at the outset, say, of course, this is at the pleading stage. This is an appeal that has been allowed from an order that was on a motion to dismiss the third amended complaint, which was filed against North American Galvanizing. The complaint says, and it is a fact, that the Metropolitan Water District voluntarily has incurred response costs under CERCLA, or costs that would be classified as CERCLA costs. It admits no liability, and it asserts it did not release hazardous chemicals at its property. On that basis alone, it should be fairly clear that this plaintiff is entitled to a 107 remedy. We think that given the state of the law and in the aftermath of Avial, The district court did do an admirable and supportable job of finding that the Water Reclamation District has the right to pursue what the district court termed a implied Section 107 right of contribution, a remedy of contribution. We do suggest that there's a better way for the district court to have worded its finding, not that it's wrong, but that the nature of plaintiff's CERCLA rights are statutory, and if you follow the reasoning of the Consolidated Edison case, they're fairly plain and on the face of the law. We further suggest that the reasoning of Consolidated Edison is actually wholly consistent with the Axo case, the Rumke case. These are previous cases decided by this court in this circuit. The judge, I think, was dealing with two questions. First of all, what kind of cause of action is there? And second, what is the remedy? The cause of action we were pleading, obviously, was a 107 cause of action. We had conceded on the briefs that if we had simply a freestanding 113 claim, that would fall because of Avial. That was the freestanding 113 claim that would fall. We think the judge was possibly influenced by the language of the U.S. Supreme Court when it reviewed CERCLA at an earlier time in a case called Keytronic, which we cite in our briefs. And in that case, what the Supreme Court found was that 107 does indeed create a remedy, but it called it an implied right of action. Given that the Supreme Court in Keytronic called it an implied right of action, I would suggest that Judge Zagel may have felt constrained to call it anything else, although I would point out that Justice Scalia, in the Keytronic dissent that he wrote, said that the language was plain enough, it creates an express cause of action. There's no question in my mind that the Supreme Court's law in Keytronic and the law of this circuit provides that there is a cause of action for the proper plaintiff under Section 107. We pled ourselves as a proper plaintiff, namely a innocent landowner who had not actually polluted the site. And in that sense, we should win right there. But the district judge did find that we could not, in his mind, be an innocent landowner. His construction of that exemption was influenced by the North Star opinion. I think if this court analyzes the North Star opinion, it should find that it wasn't quite right either, and therefore Judge Zagel wasn't quite right. The North Star opinion emphasizes the timing of a purchase of property. That is not the language of Rumke. That is not the language of Axo.
The counsel,
yes,
for the appellant suggested that we have anticipated the Supreme Court's recent decision in the Rumke decision, and that that we really would have to overrule Rumke in order to reach the result which you are urging on us today.
Indeed.
Could you comment on that, please?
I would be happy to. I believe that this court did anticipate the issue that is posed here today in its opinion in Rumke. It resolved the issue at that time in a rather straightforward way. Rumke had pleaded, as did this plaintiff, a 107 claim, and in the alternative it pleaded a 113 claim. This court in Rumke said, if it turns out on the proof that you're not a innocent party, that you bear liability, then you just proceed in your 113 claim. Query: is that option still alive after Avial Services? I honestly think it is. It's not the only way to look at this law, but the one way you'd look at the law and say it is that our complaint is the 107 action, We're bringing a 113 action during that time. That fits exactly in the language of 113F1, the CERCLA statute that grants the contribution right expressly during or following a 106 or 107 case. Now, Judge Zegel did not adopt that approach. And in a sense, it's understandable in the aftermath of Avial, given the consternation Avial caused. He instead said there's an implied right of remedy called contribution. I agree there's absolutely a remedy to be read out of 107. I think 107 itself expresses what it is. It's the recovery of costs. The question then becomes, what if you don't think someone is totally entitled? Instead of total, there's something less than the whole. What do you do? It becomes like a contribution case. I think that's what Judge Zegel was saying. But there's no doubt, if you read the cases such as decided 107 contribution claims prior to 113 being enacted, and there are a couple of very important ones cited in our brief. One is Colorado versus ASARCO, and the other one is United States versus Newcastle County. And in each case, the court goes at length into the statutory history. In ASARCO, they point out that the sponsors of this legislation intended that the district courts would fashion the remedy appropriately using principles of common law. I can think of no clearer statement than the committee report cited there that that was the intent. Indeed, if you think about it, there's no such language as joint and several liability sitting there in 107. It doesn't use those words. Those words were taken out of the statute before it was actually passed, as was a contribution provision from one of the leading bills. They left it to the courts to fashion the appropriate remedy on the facts in a given case. And we think the better way to, for Judge Zegel to have expressed it would have been to say it's like contribution, but as the Supreme Court, even in Avial, says in footnote 3, it's a distinct remedy. Now Justice Breyer sat on the panel in the First Circuit in a case called United Technologies versus Browning Ferris. At that time, it wasn't the same facts, so the question didn't come up, but in a footnote he says, where you have a plaintiff that has voluntarily incurred costs, we think there may be an implied right like contribution. But these cases all say there's a 107 remedy, there's a 113 remedy. They're distinct. In Keytronic, the language of the Supreme Court is they're similar and somewhat overlapping. So in a sense, they are analogous. But it's really a 107 form of relief, and you can call it contribution and do so honorably, as Judge Zegel did. And you can also characterize it as a remedy in terms of 107 itself, and say it's sui generis, it's out of the intent of Congress. After all, if there is no remedy for a voluntary plaintiff, then Superfund, as we have known this statute for 25 years, is essentially gone, except for cases where the government itself, state or federal, takes a very active role. That was not the intent. The reason why this circuit's rulings were not really overruled in Consolidated Edison, at least, and don't have to be at least for this case, is we have in this case the innocent landowner that was always allowed to bring a case. Query whether Consolidated Edison in its reasoning would extend the right of being a 107 plaintiff to a person such as a person who admittedly perhaps dumped at a given site and so was a generator along with a host of others. And such a person stepped up to the plate and voluntarily cleaned up and sought a 107 remedy query whether that's an issue where relief should be granted. We think it should. It's not necessarily this case, because we're the innocent landowner where we did not pollute. And finally, the reason why this is not exactly contribution is, again, emphasized by the fact this is a voluntary cleanup. The way AXO, in its language, defined contribution, and the reason why AXO was remitted to its 113 remedy is these are costs that the plaintiff has been compelled to bear. AXO itself had been ordered to do cleanup. Therefore, it was a compelled plaintiff. Therefore, it was like and was, in fact, contribution that it was seeking. We are not a compelled plaintiff. We are a voluntary plaintiff. We are a responsible landlord. And I would emphasize again that we are not in this case with this particular defendant suing our tenant. North American Galvanizing is the parent of our tenant. We do have separately, and it's still alive in the district court, a piercing claim. But the theory of our case here is that North American Galvanizing is like a third party. They are either an arranger, they did things, said things, directed things to leave bad stuff at our facility, or they actually took enough control to be called an operator. That's the theory. It's a pure CERCLA theory. It's not related to a contractual relationship, at least not any one that could be called direct. Are there any other questions?
I don't think so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sheldon. Mr. Jones.
Couple of points. First, as to whether this court really did anticipate the result of Cooper Services versus Aviol. I quote from page 1241 of that opinion. If it turns out that Rumpke is not the innocent party it portrays itself to be, then Rumpke will not qualify for the AXO exemption. It would still be entitled to seek contribution for its expenses from other PRPs, assuming it met the requirements of section 113F1. In parentheses, we acknowledge, as other courts have, that this seems to provide a disincentive for parties voluntarily to undertake cleanup operations because 106 and 107 apparently must either be ongoing or already completed before the 113 contribution claim is available. This appears to be what the statute requires, however.
Now, is that necessary to the holding of this case, or is that dicta?
No, that is clearly dicta. However, it shows that the holding in Rumpke is perfectly consistent with the holding in Aviol.
But why should this panel be governed by a breezy parenthetical comment? I mean, that's basically what it is.
Yes, I don't think this panel should be governed by that. But I think if this panel is of the belief that perhaps Cooper Services versus Aviol is inconsistent with Rumpke, and clearly it's not inconsistent, so Cooper Services does not give reason to reconsider that precedent. That precedent is expressly consistent with the holding that was eventually reached in Aviol, which, by the way, is simply an interpretation of the plain text of Section 113. The second point is to emphasize that Rumpke was the case of a voluntary plaintiff. Those were the facts. The plaintiff admitted that it had not been sued under Section 106. It had not been issued an administrative order of any kind. It was a plaintiff in precisely the situation of the district in this case. So the voluntary basis of, or asserted voluntary basis here, is not a basis for revisiting or distinguishing Rumpke. I'd also like to point out that the Keytronic Supreme Court case that the plaintiff relies on was expressly disregarded by the Supreme Court in Cooper versus AVL Services, which said basically this issue wasn't presented. Keytronic has nothing to say to us on this issue. So the reliance on that, I think, is a mistake.
We did have a couple of justices, though, who thought they ought to get the whole job done, right?
Yes, they did. They're in the minority, of course. The final point is I'd like to end by reemphasizing that what the Supreme Court majority did say is look to the cases of Texas Industries and Northwest Airlines before you make this decision about an implied right of contribution. And as the justices recognized there, the decision to create implied rights of contribution is a matter of high policy, best left to the legislative process, because the range of factors to be weighed demonstrates the inappropriateness of judicial resolution of this complex issue. Ascertaining what is fair in this setting calls for an inquiry into the entire spectrum of, in that case, the antitrust law, not simply the elements of a particular case or category of cases. I think that's a strong argument for judicial deference, and I think it's a strong argument for stare decisis.
Is there anything else in the text of the statute or its structure or its legislative history that would indicate that Congress meant to leave people like Metro Water high and dry? I mean, does it make sense in terms of what the statute is trying to accomplish?
I think it does, and to understand why, it's important to understand how Congress fit the contribution remedy into the statutory scheme. The incentives in the scheme are built around the settlement provisions, and the incentive is not, I don't think, to encourage voluntary parties to strike out on their own to clean up properties, perhaps for their own financial benefit if they're the landowner. I think the incentives are to force responsible parties to cooperate with the government when the government takes an interest in a site. And that's why the contribution remedy is withheld unless and until the private party settles its liability with the United States or a state. If there's been no suit, no civil action under Section 106 and 107, the way that a private party gets a right of contribution is to settle its liability with the state or United States, come to terms, figure out the payments, figure out what the cleanup's going to be. And I think that's the scheme that Congress intended. And I also think it's further bolstered by the contribution provision. Another incentive to settlement is the settlement bar, that once you do settle your liability, you're protected from claims by other parties. By giving them a 107 claim, you'd undermine that protection. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.